Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 22nd of Tammuz. Today we're going to talk about the Tzitzit Eliezer view of how we choose our communal leaders. Now, it's only after I came back to recording this discussion that I realized that just 9 days ago we discussed Rav Uziel's view of choosing communal leaders. This Tshuva by the Tzitzit Eliezer is also from before the State of Israel was founded. It's from the 22nd of Tammuz of Tav Shin Zayin of 1947. So it was right on the verge of remarkable things happening in Palestine and then the State of Israel. I don't ordinarily do the same topic over and over again, and I don't intend to, but I think when I was choosing them, this is one that came up to me and was fascinating and interesting because it's a very different view from that of Rav Uziel's, and I think it offers a new view of democracy, a different view of democracy than we are used to, and one that seems to me is A, more traditional, and B, more effective and more productive, it seems to me, as we'll see as we go through the tshuva. This response is from Chelek Gimel Chavtet, right? It's from the third volume of Tzitzit Eliezer, response number 29, and it's about choosing communal leaders. So he notes that the people sending him the letter have had lots of fights about who should be the parnasim, who should be the leaders, who should have the communal power over various assets that the community has, especially, let's say, in a shul. Shuls have monies and they have a property and they all sometimes have valuable gold and silver decorations for the Sifrei Torah and for things like that. And so there's some financial element to this as well, and there's some power element in terms of assessing members, in terms of laying out costs, right? There are shul functionaries who make decisions that affect millions of dollars, and those millions of dollars eventually have to come from the community. And this community, whatever that was having a fight about all these issues. They wanted to know who were supposed to be their leaders. They had sent him, in the Eliezer's view, they sent him five central questions. Question one was, in what way do we pick leaders? Is there like a Hatorah way that one should pick leaders? Second question, who's qualified to be a leader in these situations, to oversee communal things? This comes up in lots of situations at shuls, but I've done it, let's say, on co-op boards, right? If you have a co-op that has a building that's worth however many millions of dollars, people are going to go on the board, they make decisions affecting the whole co-op. Question number two. Question number three is, to what extent is it true that decisions of this board or of the leaders of a community obligate the community itself, right? That was a question we've seen before. How much is somebody required to follow the lead of the community? Question number four was, let's say you have a community that feels the need to split. What do they do with their communal assets? And question number five was, let's say, these last two questions we're not going to get to very much. And question number five was, is there a right of a communal leader to bequeath his position, as it were, to his sons after him, to his children after him? Mostly we're going to talk about the first three questions. So, on the question of how to pick the people who lead the community, the answer notes, and this is 1947, so he's 31 years old, he points out that he's already had a tshuva about this to Hapoel HaMizrahi, and that's an earlier tshuva, and the Hapoel HaMizrahi was to whom Rabbi Uziel was answering as well. So I brought up that tshuva because it's central to this tshuva as well. So I just give you his conclusions from that tshuva. Tzitzit Eliezer in that tshuva, which was in volume 2, response 24, he had concluded that one, as long the length of time that a person needs to live in a community to have the right to vote is generally 12 months, as we've seen before, as Ruziel had said, but he says if we know that the man plans to live there right away, then he moves into a community and it's clear that he's staying, then he's already a member of the community. That's especially true if he bought a place to live. That will also make him like a member of the community. And according to one opinion in Shulchan Aruch, even if he bought it, but we know that he plans to leave in a year or two, doesn't matter. As soon as he bought a place, that makes him a member of the community in terms of having interests in that community, and therefore he is a voting member. However, this is the Ezra holds that if the property came into his possession by inheritance or by a gift, since he hasn't worked at it, that doesn't immediately show that he tends to live there. And to the Ezra's view is that unless somebody's planning on living there, they don't have voting rights in that community, and that's why the next rule that he makes is as well, that just owning land doesn't give somebody a voting right in the community. Now that, to me, there's some interest there, because one could argue that if one has land in a community or was inherited property in a community, even if they don't plan to live there, I might have thought they should have some voting rights because the decisions of the community affect them and their property as well. We'd have to go into this at more length another time, but the Zilezer doesn't seem to see it that way. It could be that that's because the Zilezer feels that unless somebody is living in a community, they don't have the full perspective of what's going on in that community, so they can weigh in on it, or they don't have to bear the consequences as much as other people do, and therefore they can't weigh in on it. I would just note that there's some element in which they bear those consequences, and you might have thought that that would be an issue as well. Rule number four, or principle number four that he advances, is that in order to be considered by the community, it's not only that one has to have property there and demonstrate an interest in living there, one has to pay whatever taxes are required, whatever taxes, fees, membership, all those kinds of things would be required in order to be a voting member, as Rav Uziel had said. And all of this there's no distinction between the functions that the community fulfills, meaning if it's only a religious community, that's a community. If it's a municipal community, that's a community. Whatever community it might be, these are the rules. And then here's where he's going to start parting from Rav Uziel, and we'll talk about it more in the course of this tshuva, of the current tshuva, not just the one that we're now reviewing from before. He says he thinks that ideally, the term is lachatchila, which I've pointed out in many situations in halacha, in pure halacha, lachatchila means this is what one has to do, only that sometimes after the fact, if it's done a different wrong way, it can be acceptable. Here, I think lachatchila means the ideal, the best idea. So that blurring of that word has ramifications for other halakhic discussions that we've had. But in any case, in this case, he says, it should be al-pi rov binyan, virov binyan. So this is a long-standing halakhic principle that people forget that I think is an important issue within democracy that we've lost sight of. Democracy, as it's practiced today, is one man, one vote. So they're going to point out here, and as our current tshuva goes on, that traditionally that wasn't the halakhic way. The halakhic way was to split it and to say that you want a majority by vote, by one man, one vote, but also you want a majority of rov binyan. The hainu lefi, he says, lefi rov mispar nefashot, lefi rov hamamon, that the majority of the money whoever pays more has some rights as well. So that's an element of it that people sort of recoil from today. Truth is, not that I am actually a big opponent of campaign finance, but the way campaigns work in the United States today, one might argue that that allows for some of this to take place. But the tradition of rov binyan, rov binyan was the people who pay the money, who pay more of the costs of running that community, should also have somewhat more of a right to weigh in on it for reasons that we'll see as we go on. But a simple, obvious reason right at the start would be that they, in that sense, have more of a stake in it, even if it's true that they're blessed with more money. So even if we say, well, they're giving the same percentage, right? So-and-so person who gives, just to pick numbers, $100 a year to the community is actually giving the same exact percentage of his income and assets as so-and-so who gives $100,000 to the community. That may be true. And the poor person shouldn't be left out of the discussion at all, but the person who's giving them more money does have more invested financially in it. It's just as a pure amount, even though percentages might be the same. So the tradition was that you split those two and that you try to put together in making communal decisions both rov minyan and rov binyan, that you survey the population, one man, one vote, and that was an element of it, and then also that you survey the wealthy people, and that was an element of it. We'll come back to that. Next principle that comes up with is that there was a time when it was assumed that Tamidei Chachamim, and not just rabbis, like official functioning rabbis as communal functionaries, but that anybody who was a Torah scholar, and the definition of that is a topic for a completely other time, but could be something of a matter of contention, as we'll see for the reason for right now, which is that they weren't required to pay taxes, to pay communal taxes, and that can obviously cause a lot of tension, right? It means that, I know certainly in my community in Riverdale, there are people in various shuls that I davened in who are not functioning as rabbis in any way, but are clearly Torah scholars. The tradition would have been that those people would not have to pay communal membership and various other community taxes, and the Tzitzileza says, for all that they don't pay, they get to vote anyway, because their lack of paying does not mean they're not members of the community. It means the community, and the tradition is, they're not required to pay. That's not going to come up so much today. I just thought it was worth throwing in there to think about and to realize, because I think it's an idea It's an underlying attitude. Forget who qualifies as Talmid Chacham as a Torah scholar, but it's an underlying attitude that I'm not sure we've kept alive today. And then the last point was that he thinks that there's room to change the ways in which people elect their leaders. It's all a matter of custom in every city, in every community. And if they want to change it for some reason, then they can change it. But the way to change it is by establishing a new custom by according to the will of the majority of the people, of all or the majority. Or sometimes, if the community picks leaders and gives them rights, and this Rav Uziel already said it as well, gives them rights to change certain things, then if those leaders decide to change those things, even if it's a one person, if they gave them the right to be in charge of that and to make decisions about that, then they can change the custom. And then once they change the custom, if they act upon it three times, that becomes the new system. So if for whatever reason you have a community that for a while you had to be a homeowner of a home worth, just to pick a stupid number, $2 million before you could vote. And then those homeowners came to decide, for whatever reason, they needed to broaden the voting perspective, the voting rights of people, and they elected a committee, and that committee looked into it and said, we have a whole new system, whatever it would be, and that's going to allow that whoever owns anything, property, where they can live, that will qualify to vote. So once they do it three times that way, that will become the new communal custom. And then if somebody wanted to say, no, we want to revert back to it, they would need either a majority of the community to vote on it or the properly elected leaders to decide that was true. So that's the old tshuva. That's what he said so far in a previous response. One of the elements of the Tzitzeliezer that I've been noticing as I've gone through some of his tshuvot, is that he, more than other respondents that I've seen, although maybe I just haven't seen enough of the other respondents, will refer people back to previous tshuvot. He seems to have had not only a very good memory for other sources, but an extraordinarily good memory also for what he's written and where he's written it, and he will very often send the reader back to earlier tshuvot. So now in our current tshuva, and so all this that we did came because I looked up the previous tshuva, and that's what I did. So now, to add to the, to clarify further, he says he wants to add a few points. So, first point he's going to add in this tshuva is that anybody who's being picked for a position of svara, position of communal authority, has to be chosen by the community according to the rules of the government, right? We follow the rules of the government. So if the government says it has to be democratic for whatever reason, then it wouldn't be acceptable to just decide it's going to be one person's right to vote on it. It has to follow the rules of the government. And part of the reason he says that has to be true is that if you don't do it that way, then people are going to get into fights and you're going to ruin communal peace and communal sense of brotherhood, which are both important elements of a community for Tzitz Eliezer. And I stress that because I have more and more come to meet people who seem to care less about it. Meaning, as a theoretical abstract question, if I have one shul and then they split into two shuls, is that in and of itself good, neutral, or bad? I've met more people than I would have thought who will say, there's nothing wrong with it. And so the Ezra is saying, there's something wrong with it because communal peace. And so they'll say, well, we're all peaceful. But the idea that we go our separate ways and therefore we're peaceful is not nearly as good a peace, I'm pretty sure, that the Ezra would tell us, as if things stay together. So that's, and these ways of electing people that are common to that state, to that community, so that people will feel that they're being, that their leaders are being chosen in a proper, appropriate way, that's still the answer, is an important element of how we choose communities, how we build communities, and we need to continue doing it in a way that people will feel good about it, and it will also lead to, if you have things split up or upset, that people will stop donating to the community as much as they could. And he means it as in, not that the community is going to split, he means, let's say there's a community, and people get upset about something, and they feel that their voices have been heard, and they feel the leader's been chosen the wrong way, they'll just give less. And if they give less, as the other says, it's not what they'll do with their tzedakah money is not his problem, but it will be problematic for the poor of that community because there won't be as much money around for them to receive that money. I sadly have seen this in action as well. I've done it myself, that there are certain times if there's a cause that I tended to support and then I think that they're handling it wrong or badly, I will not give as much. So the idea of making sure that people stay invested, emotionally invested and rationally invested, that they feel comfortable that a community is being built in a proper, good, appropriate way, as you're saying, is not just a matter of how the community goes. It affects people who are vulnerable. It affects the poor. It affects the amount of money that's going to be out there for them. And that's a real point, and therefore it's important to make sure the communities choose their leaders in a way that everybody can recognize as fair and appropriate and proper. In addition, the Mohavra Anach, who was an important Achron, says, there's a quote to me saying that if people just come and grab authority, then there'll be a lot of fights. And when there are fights, then there might be Ramaim, right? There might be fakers, there might be thieves, there might be cheaters, there might be swindlers, and it will end up stealing money from the poor because they'll mishandle it, and the rich will refrain from giving to it. I certainly myself would give less to a communal fund or institution for the poor if I didn't trust the people running it. I thought they weren't handling it well, that there were problems with it, and therefore it will lead to a cessation of charity for the poor, and you might have, God forbid, poor people dying of famine. That's what Tzitzil is quoting from the Mohavra Anach. Therefore, he says, this is back to Tzitzil Ezer, therefore he says that Torah scholars and leaders of every generation made rules that everybody should find comfortable and appropriate and good, and vidnotim ladin Torah, and they come close to Torah law, meaning the Torah didn't explicitly define a way to choose leaders, but Tzedezer thinks that these have a Torah element to them, a Torah aspect to them, of way of picking the leaders of a community such that all of the people will be overseen in everything they do. So it's not quite Torah law, but it comes close to some issue of Torah law, has a Torah element to it, and when you choose them in this way, everybody will feel, and we as the students of the people who came before us will feel like everybody is doing well. He invokes the verse from Ha'azinu She'alavicha, Ha'azinu? I think it is. Ha'azinu She'alavicha v'yakeitcha zikeinecha v'yamrulach, that we should consult with our Torah scholars, our Torah leadership, on issues of life in general, and they can tell it to us, and it will lead to good outcomes for us if we do so in the right way. So he saw Shut Maharash Dam and the Maharash Dam. So it's not, there's going to be a couple of opinions on this issue. The Maharash Dam, and he's going to quote, these are a bunch of 16th century sources. I note that just because it's interesting to me that all the sources that he found were from a particular century. It suggests that it was right then that the questions of choosing leaders became more active than they had been in a while back and became closest to what we currently do. And so those are the sources that he quotes. So the Maharash Dam was asked about choosing a chazan for a community, choosing a rabbi for a community, choosing the other, and figuring out the other communal needs. And he said he thinks it's just a simple majority. That was a question. I'm sorry. Should you do it by a simple majority, or should you go according to the majority of the wealthy people, even if there's many more people who are unwealthy? And his answer, the Maharash Dam's answer, was that the idea of majority rules is when the people who are making the choice are equal to each other. That's when the majority comes back. So we'll come back to this later, but let's say you have all the people on the Sanhedrin, and so the Sanhedrin is made up of great Torah scholars, and therefore, in a particular sense, they're all equals of each other. There, the majority makes sense. But when there's a difference between the two groups, then he says sometimes you could have one person who's as valuable as 1,000. That's what Maharash Dam says. So let's suppose that a bunch of people who never learn more than what you get in a yeshiva day school education through 12th grade are standing around, and some well-recognized Torah scholar, not named names, but some the Tzitz Eliezer, you know, if he were still alive, we still have the benefits of his wisdom in our presence. Still, he comes in and they get talking about some Torah idea, and let's suppose it's a real pure halakhic idea. It's not even a question of hashkafic issues, which some people will tell you are more or less clear. There's some pure, simple halakhic question, and you've got 100 yeshiva day school graduates, and this is the history, and the 100 yeshiva day school graduates are all sure that halakha is X way, and the answer is sure that it's Y way. So would you take a majority vote? So that's what the Maharash Dam is struggling with, and it's an element that people forget in the discussion of democracy. While it may be true that we can't always know who knows better and who doesn't know better, there are issues on which some people know better and some people don't know better. This will not be the final word. This is just Maharash Dam's words. Maharash Dam is pointing out that when we talk about majority rule, the only place it makes sense to talk about majority rules in a case where everybody is basically equal in terms of their knowledge and understanding and appreciation of how to choose certain things, and that would be where it is. But if there's one person who's much more knowledgeable, that he can outweigh 1,000 people. And then he adds, even more controversially for discussions we might have today, and then he adds that wealth is a foreign, he says, Ha'osha karov l'malat ha'chokhma, is close to the level of wisdom. I think what he means is wealth is a form of wisdom, such that if you have wealthy people as opposed to non-wealthy people and issues of finance come up, then you're going to have to trust the wealthy people more because they have greater insight into it. This again is something that people would object to greatly today, although I think that that would be, to some extent, we're not going to talk about the flaw, I think to some extent that's going to have the same flaws as just seeing wealth as a kind of wisdom in it, in that if we just say that, well, everyone spends money the same way, it's unfortunately untrue, right? Poorer people tend, not always, but tend to have less financial insight because they deal with finances a different way than wealthier people, and that, not that wealthy people know everything, but that is an issue that needs to come up. So the Maharaj Dham's answer was that when we select and we're making decisions that affect communal finances, the people who are wealthy should have much more influence. And then we talk about rov, about picking things by majority. It's rov tuvei ha'ir ba'alei kisim, the majority of the communal leaders who are the wealthy in general, even if they are the minority in terms of pure numbers. That's the way the Maharaj Dham saw it. We're not going to stop there, but his view was the wealthy know better and they better understand it. Let's say today, if a shul is going to build a building for whatever reason, let's suppose it's a reasonably good idea to build a building, you're going to take out a mortgage, let's say it's a $30 million mortgage, which is an unbelievably large amount of money to think about. Who is going to be better able to really think about the consequences of this mortgage and how it works? Not that poor people won't know anything about it, but in terms of dealing with finances, the wealthy people would have more insight, and therefore the Maharaj Dham thought they should have more of an influence, and they're the ones whose opinion should count. That's not the final word. That's Torah Chaim HaSfaradi. There are two Torah Chaims. Torah Chaim HaSfaradi, who's also a 16th century author, he spoke about the Maharaj Dham, and he agreed that it's a matter of rov binyan and not rov minyan, that it's only the majority of people who uphold the community keep it going. And he adds that in Salonika, from time gone by, the people chosen to lead the community are the wealthy, mevini madab atzata chachamim, who understand how to run things by and consult with Torah scholars. So it's two already. It's the wealthy people who have the insight, the ability, and the understanding of how to run things, as well as Torah scholars, and they don't pay attention to the words of the majority of the people who are impoverished. And the Torah Chaim says, and it makes sense that way, because most of communal matters involve finances and spending and supervision and ideas of how to run and build and hire and all sorts of things. And if it was left to people who are not skilled at it, don't understand it, it will lead to money being wasted and money not being spent. Right? If you can imagine a co-op board, you know, go back to our co-op board that we had. You have a co-op board. The building is one of these big, has 100 apartments in it, and it's a building that's worth $20 million. They have work to do. And one of the people who got in on insider's price, they were a rent control person, got an insider price, and they make $20,000 a year. Great. And that person goes on the co-op board. It's not a yes or no issue. It might be that they're perfectly fine on the co-op board, but there's every reason to think that when it comes to dealing with such big numbers and such big issues, they won't have the same insight as a wealthier person. So in the 16th century, you've got the Maharaj Dham and you have Torah Chaim, who are saying that you have to pay attention to that, that it's not just one man, one vote. It can't be because of these problems of supervision. Now, the Tzvi Eliezer says that he has a problem because he's not sure that we can go completely after Rov Binyan when they're not equal. Tzvi Eliezer points out a whole discussion, and we'll have to skip it in the name of time, but there's a whole discussion in the Gemara about Shammai Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai being assumed by the Gemara to have been more brighter, wiser, more insightful, and Beit Hillel having been assumed to be the majority, and the Gemara seems to say that the Bible called the Divine Voice ruled in favor of Beit Hillel, and so there were many authorities who, Tzvi Eliezer quotes, who said that that shows that it's majority and not a matter of who's wiser, because wiser or sharper or more creative in their thinking seems to have been Beit Shammai. But we'll have to leave that in the name of time. Tzvi Eliezer points out that Sefer Chinuch does sound like he like something that the Maharash Dam does sound like something that Sefer Achinuch had said. The Sefer Achinuch said when we go by the majority, he said, Sefer Achinuch already said, this is in the 1200s, that that's when the two groups are wise about the Torah, equally wise about the Torah. Because you can't say, and he's talking in the context of a Sanhedrin or some other court that's making Torah decisions, you can't say that just because the people who really know and understand, right, there's a group of people who have studied all of Shas, and the two group of people have studied two Masechtot of Shas, and they're going to having a discussion about some Torah issue, you can't say the fact that the people have said only two Masechtot, or many more of them, that that's going to mean they're going to have the right. That's not the way it could work. It has to be Torah scholars who can do it. Then the Sefer Chinuch does say, but that within a Sanhedrin, we won't be midaktik. We won't just try to figure out who's smarter, who's not smarter. But that's because Sefer Chinuch seems to think, and this is an important point, once one reaches a minimum standard, then already the question of who's smarter, who's not smarter will no longer be an issue. So I know, for example, I know a certain man who's an Adam Gadol who really, really knows a tremendous amount of Torah, maybe a Kaddish Ador, however we define these things, who I think gets offended when people of much lesser knowledge weigh in on Torah issues. Part of the point that Sitzitzitz is making, that the Sefer Chinuch might hold, is that that might depend on whether they've reached a certain minimum level of knowledge. So if you have a bunch of gidolim, of anashim gidolim, of people who are great Torah scholars, but one of them is Rav Yosef Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who seems to have known more than almost anybody, but it still wouldn't have been, we might say that as long as the people he's dealing with are also widely knowledgeable in Torah, the fact that he's much more knowledgeable might not be the difference. But the fact that Rav Yosef was more knowledgeable than the average person, that might be a difference. But for all that the Maharash Dam has a point to make about Rav Chochma, so the Tzadik thinks that would only be in terms of this, that would be within a Sanhedrin, between the non-Sanhedrin and Sanhedrin members, so there might be context, there might be standards by which one would or would not be considered relevant to a decision. That's a valid point to think about, right? If somebody's never had two nickels to rip together and he's going to vote on whether a community spends millions of dollars on some project, that might in fact make sense that we would trust that person less and give them somewhat less voting rights to somebody who understands the way money works. But then the Maharash Dam, says, and whatever point the Maharash Dam has to make about wisdom and about Torah knowledge, but the fact that he then says, and a rich person is something like a wiser person in those ways, Tzadik says, how does he know that? Now, I think that it's somewhat clear because handling money and spending money and planning how we spend money and overseeing money is a form of wisdom. Tzadik was not so sure of that at all. He says, let's say if you have 90... The Maharash Dam seems to think if you have 90 poor people versus 10 rich people, Maharash Dam said that doesn't make sense because the 90 poor people can make silly decisions and that will lead to communal fractures and to fighting. So this is, but in reverse, it's not going to be true. If the rich people just run roughshod over the will of the community, and I've seen this sadly happen as well, is that going to be, is anybody going to be happy about that, right? So you have, I think in many, many communities, I had a relative once who was a president of a community who pointed out to me, and I think it's true in many communities, that the bulk of communal expenditures often come from a very small group. Five people is what, in this community, it was an out of New York community, a small community, and the bulk of communal expenditures came from five people. So let's say those five people said, well, listen, we pay 80% of the budget of this shul, and that might be true. And since they're going to give them some extra rights, but if they just said, well, we get to do whatever we want, the rest of the community is going to be furious. So therefore, Tzadik says we can't fully accept what the Maharash Dam said because it just doesn't work. It's going to lead to great communal tensions, and therefore we have a problem with that as well, to take away all the rights of the poor people. And Rav Yitzchak Adarbi, in a book called Divrei Revolt, which is also a 16th century book, he said that there's another, he had another practice. He said the practice of all the communities that he knew was to pick their leaders. And in that community, you'd pick a leaders of diversity. Some of them would be wealthy. Some of them would be what we would call middle class. And some of them would be poor, in a way that everybody would be represented. I think this is a very valid, very important point that has been lost today. Today, in communities for sure, boards are often picked by the leadership of the community. They pick those people who have volunteered better, or those people who they like better, or those people who have given a lot of money. And the Rav Yitzchak Adarbi is saying that we have to try to make sure we have a diverse leadership that's chosen in a way from each of the segments of the community. And I don't have time, because this shuv is so rich, I don't have time to go into this, but this seems to me a very, very important idea about democracy in all of its forms that we've lost sight of, that we need to try to find people representative of all the groups of society. And the Chasam Sofer was much later, agreed with that idea, and perhaps the Siddur says that's what the Maharaj Dham meant as well, that they can know that their leadership represents them. And maybe the Maharaj Dham, when he said that you should pick the wealthy, he meant those of the people who can have some understanding of what's going on, so that people can know that it'll be handled well, whoever they may be. He closes with another idea that Masab bin Yamin had from the Mahari Adarbi, also from Yisrael Adarbi, who had said that when they wanted to pick communal leaders, what they would do is everybody in the community would get together, and then from the first thing they would do, and this I also think is an idea I've tried to recommend to people many times, but I have not yet succeeded, that the communal people get to choose people who will choose the leaders, meaning if there are going to be seven leaders, today we might call them an executive board, so that the communal people will not choose those executive board. They will choose the people who will choose that executive board. My own personal idea, I know I'm not supposed to stick it into the response, but let's suppose in a community, every 10 people had the right to choose a member of the broader board. So if you have a 600-member community, and 10 members get to choose, you come up with a board of 60, which is kind of unwieldy, but that board of 60, if those 60, every 10 of them got to choose an executive committee member, then that would be what Rav Yitzchak Adarbi was talking about as well. The community all has a voice, but that voice is sort of filtered through the choice of the leaders they choose to choose the leader. So he includes, Rav points out, he includes all the members of the community, not whether they're rich, not whether they're poor, but anybody who pays taxes, and then it goes on from there to choose the best leaders. So halacha, just to close it up, halacha, the Tzitzit Ezra thinks that if you don't pay taxes, then you don't have the right to vote, but if you pay taxes, you have the right to vote, but he thinks that it's supposed to be a mix of Rav Binyan and Rav Binyan. You should put it all together in that the wealthy get some more rights, although because they have that say of this, but that fundamentally he thinks that it should be everybody having the feeling that they have a voice and they have a say and their opinions matter to the community, and then God willing, we can build communities of peace and love and brotherhood that will function together, making tough decisions, everybody realizing decisions can't always go their way, but tough decisions that everybody feels comfortable were made and everybody's best interest to the best of our abilities to do so. And that is a response of a day from the Tzitzit Eliezer on the better, on a better form, to see what seems to me a better form of democracy, a response of a day for the 22nd of Tammuz. Have a great day.